Whenever I visit France, I always see lots of top bottles for sale, but when I get back home, those same bottles can be much harder to find, if not impossible. That's why I use idealwine.com. At idealwine.com, I can buy wines directly from France for delivery directly to my home. They have new auctions every week, and the fixed price selection is equally awesome. Clos Vougeard, Chateau Reyes, and Ulysse Collan, as well as many more greats from all over France, are regularly available on the website. Best of all, it is simple and hassle-free to buy them. Ideal Wine handles all the customs and logistics hurdles for you and for me. Wines are ordered with a couple of clicks, and then they arrive. It is simple. Check out idealwine.com for more information. That's IDEALWINE.com to find what you'd like to be drinking.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Pierre Murray on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Bien, malgré le froid, mais c'est un temps de saison.
Well, but I'm happy to see that it's a seasonal weather, and he's hoping for a great vintage like all the vintages in Nine. With the exception of 1939, in the 20th century, all the vintages were good.
So actually, the 1930s is when your father, Auguste Murray, returned to the domain to work with his father, who was getting a bit ill at that time.
Oui, exactement. Mon père,
yes, my father left because he could not make enough money making wine in the family estate. He did make more money selling pharmaceutical products than making wine. But at the time, my grandfather, his father, called him back and said that if you're not back soon, I'm going to sell everything. And the virus of winemaking just took over. So at the time where my father came back, I think my grandfather had maybe 5 hectares. However, there was an opportunity that arose to take over a métayage from the Domaine des Comtes Lafond. But we did not get the métayage all in one lump. It came bit by bit. The first parcels that they got were Meursault, Labarre, not Clos de Labarre, Genevrière, Perrière, and Charme. And Montrachet only came much later, around 1964. The only things that the actual Moret family owned at the time was just regional appellations, Meursault, White, and Red. And the pinnacle was Meursault les Tessons at the time. Unfortunately, my father bought too little, at least to my taste. There was a lot of investment already going on at Domaine Moret. There was a new tractor, Enjambeur, the type that straddles the vineyards, which was fresh off the building line. Bought a new electric press, a Vasselin, and he had just bought a house, so he was covered in debt.
In relation to the rest of the Côte d'Or, your father was a little ahead of the time when it came to equipment, both in the vineyard and in the winery. And these are things that you would have seen as a kid.
J'ai vécu ça étant gamin, j'ai une photo.
Yes, I fondly remember a picture of myself as a kid under the new tractor Enjambeur when my father bought it. But there were a few predecessors, Michelot, Rougeau, for example, who built their own with local artisans. As soon as he saw that there was a company that was going to put out a tractor that would have proper equipment, follow through, pieces needed to repair it, and so on and so forth, he was the first one on the list to buy it. It was Maison Loiseau in Meursault. But unfortunately, he didn't have money at the time, so that there's two Champenois who came down and bought the two first tractors out of under him, and he got number three.
Because the coincidence there is that the Loiseau factory that made the over-row tractors that you're talking about was based in Meursault, and so was your father.
Oui, c'est ça, l'usine.
Yes, we were only about 500 meters away from the factory.
What was your father like as a person, and what was he like when you were growing up?
My father was pretty severe, a patriarch, you could say. Not in a military sense, but As I was the eldest, it was my duty to show the example to my brother and my two sisters. My father got married in 1936, 1937, and had a daughter, and immediately left for the war in 1939. He was made prisoner in May 1940, but was taken prisoner into Germany, about 10 kilometers away from Poland, in a very cold area there, and that's where he spent the war. He found out in 1942 that his wife had passed, and it was allowed by the Germans for people who had lost a spouse to come back to France, but the administrative details were very, very complicated, so it took till 1943 for him to come back. So he met my mother in the farm at which he would go get milk for the family, and I was born in 1948.
What was Meursault like as a village at that time, in the 50s? What was it like?
I was born in a house where there was no running water, no heat, no bathroom, and the outhouse was in the yard. And we still had ration tickets, coupons you could get goods with at the end of the war, and that lasted for a couple of years after. We lived at the very tail end of a street, and we got running water in 53.
That probably helped with the vinification to have running water.
Ça a aidé évidemment beaucoup de choses.
It helped a lot of things. Imagine cleaning a press at the time with a bucket of water that you went to get at the hand fountain 100 meters away. You had to walk 100 meters away to get running water.
At one point, the members of the Lafon family wanted to sell the property, but René Lafon convinced them not to do that and to continue with the domain. Do you remember that period of time when there was talk of selling it?
This happened when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and this was the point at which the family was in discussion of either selling or doing a métayage. They found an administrative way to put together the property, which is called an SCI. And this is what permitted René Lafon to take charge and to keep the domain together. Of course, I often heard my parents talk about this because had there been a sale, it would have totally changed what we were doing on the domain since we had the métayage. One, we lived in a house that was owned by the Lafons, and they might have told us to go take a hike if they sold it. And the second of all, the most prestigious wines we had in our cellar came from the métayage that my father had with Lafon.
What are your memories of working with your father in the vineyards and in the winery?
Alors, à la vigne,
my childhood memory of working the vineyards was during the vacations, we would prune. Easter vacations, we would do canopy management and tie branches to the trellising. We couldn't do the debudding because that needed a little bit more experience. However, we did the canopy management, like bringing the wires up to bring the canopy in neatly into the row, and it's really beautiful to see a vine that's properly done. Of course, there was no equipment to mechanically do top canopy management, cutting off the head of the vine. So we did it by hand with my brother with those large scissors, and it was a little bit of a race between him and me.
I wonder if that means that people trimmed less back then.
Ah oui, nous commencions à rogner.
Yes, at the time, we did that much later. Today, with the mechanization and the tractors that we have and the equipment, leads to multiple canopy managements. And people start often way too early in the cycle before flower, and that hurts the vine. So at the time, vinification was very classic. It was just pressed. However, there was no triage at the time, so even if there was botrytis on the vines, that would go onto the press. At the time, you could relatively easily ask pickers to get rid of the botrytis and do a triage in the vineyard. It's much more complicated today with what you can ask and not ask a picker to do. The one thing that he did take great care in is when he decanted the juice in order to choose what he was going to use for actual vinification.
So he's saying that there was less sorting at that time because this was before sorting tables for grapes in the winery, but that he was very careful with what would be called débourbage, which is the settling of the juice and the lees. So this is something he paid a lot of attention to.
Absolutely. At the time, there wasn't enologists coming every 5 minutes trying to sell you some kind of product that was going to accelerate the débourbage or facilitate this particular débourbage or that particular débourbage. We basically left the juice in tank overnight. And of course, we did it less if the vintage warranted doing it less. We did it more if the vintage warranted doing it more. And then we chose the juices that we would bleed off to make the wine. I didn't change much. We pretty much stayed true to what was being done at the domain before. I continue doing batonnage because if it's well done, it's necessary for the wine up till Christmas. And if you decant too much and you do not leave enough lees, you put it in the barrel and it's very clear wine. And there's nothing to baton, there's nothing to actually stir. That can be dangerous, but he doesn't think that it's one of the major causes of premox, for example.
Did you end up going to school for vinification, or did you learn mostly with your father?
I went to school, but not enough to my liking. Right after high school, right after my certificate, I went into an agricultural school, which was both agriculture and viticulture. It was alternating, so many weeks in class, so many weeks on the farm. I did that for 3 years, and then that was it. You know, I was a strong lad, and my family needed the help, and it was a time to come back and work for the family.
Did you see differences between the Moret Genelot wines and the Lafon wines from the same parcels? Did you see differences resulting from the vinification?
Oui, les vins étaient toujours différents.
Yes, there were differences. When I had occasion to taste the Lafon wines, which I didn't have that many occasions to taste, but I was able to taste them, I could see a stylistic difference between the wines from my family that were done on the same plots and the wines from Lafon done on the same plots. It had much to do with the élevage of the wines, whereas we didn't have much space, so basically 12 months after putting them in barrel, they were racked out and bottled, and Lafon could continue sometimes 18 months, sometimes all the way up to 2 or more years in barrel before bottling, in exceptional cases. There was a difference, and it was fascinating. They were very different when they were young, the wines. But I might talk to Dominique and propose a tasting of the same plots, 30 to 40 years bottle age.
In general, what did you see as the character of those different plots between Charme, Genevrier, Perrier, and then later Le Mont Rocher?
Quand je produisais les trois premiers crus majeurs de Meursault.
When I used to vinify all three, I would tell my clients to start with the Charme, then you can open up your Genevrière and then just hide the Perrier at the end of the cellar. The Charme could be considered the archetypal Meursault, which has a lot of grace, beauty, nuts, a lot of minerality, especially when it's produced towards the top of the vineyard. Genevrière has a lot of finesse. We often say that it smells of the flower of the vine, but definitely more notes of alcohol when they're on their youth. And Perrier, I don't really think Perrier belongs truly to Meursault in terms of archetype. It's very reserved when it's young. It takes a long time to develop, but the minerality is beautiful when it does. When I discovered the Puligny vineyards, when I worked with Lefebvre, especially Combette, I would offer up this suggestion that Combette actually belongs to Meursault and Perrier belongs to Puligny.
Because actually there's just a small road that separates them.
Oui. Hmm.
The administration probably created boundaries there that weren't probably following terroir rules. They were more following topological rules.
What was it like with Le Mont Rocher? as you started to farm and make that wine?
D'abord, une grande responsabilité.
We started working that vineyard in 1964, but it had been proposed in the late 40s, early 50s to my father to start working that vineyard, but it was too far to go with a horse. The wine was generous, was open, was fresh, was beautiful, very complete, everything you want in a wine. And Montrachet has never posed a problem during vinification. And it just tastes great from young to very, very, very old. So it was terribly, terribly exciting.
When I've been in La Montrachet, I've seen that there are clusters that are Milrandage, small clusters. And has that character increased over time? Because you have a lot of familiarity with La Montrachet over decades. Was there less Milrandage, say, in the 70s than today?
Je crois que ça dépendait beaucoup du millésime.
It depends on the vintage. And it depends on the date at which it flowers. You also have to note that there was already a vineyard close to 1,500 years ago. So, depends on the year. Montrachet is much less productive than Batard, for example, which is right downslope from Montrachet. Even though it's a warm terroir, and it's a terroir that's generous, it's still much less productive.
Sometimes people say that Montrachet holds on to its freshness, to its acidity, even when it gets ripe. Did you find that?
Oui, c'est une observation que j'ai faite.
I've always noted in this, since I started, that the Grand Crus, Batard Montrachet and Montrachet, always have a higher degree in alcohol and a higher degree in acidity, much more so than in Meursault. So I always thought that that was the definition of white Grand Cru, and when I started working Corton Charlemagne, I saw that, oh no, this is not necessarily true. The degrees in alcohol were lower in Corton Charlemagne.
As you gradually took over and the domain became Domaine Pierre Marais, and you started to do more and more of the farming of the Lafon parcels instead of your father as he went into retirement, what did you see as the differences between what maybe you wanted to do and what your father was doing?
Alors, d'abord, j'ai travaillé,
basically, not much. We shared a cellar. We worked together in the same vineyards. Indistinctly, one or the other would be pruning each other's vines. The only difference is that once you got into the cellar, some casks were marked Pierre Marais and some casks were marked Auguste Marais. And it was like that all the way to the end.
And what was the end? When did that end?
Alors, il a pris une retraite en plusieurs étapes.
My father retired in several stages. So had the right, because he had gone through World War II, to take an early retirement before 65 years old. And that's the point at which he abandoned the métayage of Comte Lafond in 1975. And my parents continued to work the vineyards from 1976 through the mid-80s. In 1984, they had to go under the value-added tax system, and they said, enough. And then after that, they would come and help us during the harvest, bottling every once in a while, but really on their own time.
In the 1980s, Dominique Lafon and Bruno Lafon came back to Comte Lafon and began to take it over from René Lafon, their father.
Oui, première récolte, 86 pour eux.
I had a lot to do with the Lafons ever since they were kids. They all came and harvested in our family vineyards. Of course, that was followed by Dominique, who started working with Becky Wasserman. And of course, because of the relationship we had with Becky Wasserman, he was always in the cellar tasting the wines as well. And so there was a lot of exchange. When Dominique and Bruno came to me to announce that this was the end of the métayage, of course, a lot of emotion because the vineyards, the family that I'd been so close to and worked so closely with, but also, you know, it's also an economic shock for the family.
Half of the wine that Domaine Pierre Marais made was from vineyards that were owned by Lafon, and they were going to take those back.
Oui, en volume,
In volume, it was about 40%, but in worth, it was way more. They did this in a very elegant manner. René Lafon, who was more or less semi-retired at the time, said, we know that this is a hardship for you, so we're going to do this progressively. And they had the supreme elegance of the last vineyard that they took back was the Moache. So there was 2 years between the announcement and the first move, and then another 5 years until all the vineyards had come back. And in between, he had started another activity.
And that activity was being the registrar for Domaine Le Fleuve.
Oui, c'est ça.
My first day at work at Le Fleuve was 1st of September 1988.
At that time, it would have been run by Vincent Le Fleuve, who died in 93, as well as Olivier Le Fleuve. And then later, Anne-Claude Le Fleuve, who was Olivier's nephew, came into the scene.
Vincent et Olivier étaient co-gérants.
So yes, Olivier and Vincent were co-CEOs of the domaine, who represented two different parts of the family. And then there was a board of directors on which Anne-Claude Le Fleuve was.
How did that job come about?
Je crois que très sagement, le domaine...
It was a relatively slow process since they were evaluating several people. There was actually a full year where I didn't even know if I was going to get the job or if I had any chance of getting it. The board of directors came in after 2 years and signed off on the choice.
By this time, 1988, when you started at Domaine Le Fleuve, you had two children, Anne, who runs Domaine Pierre Marais today, along with your help, and then Guillaume, who is the younger brother of Anne.
Oui, Anne est née en 1969.
Yes, it was a marvelous time. It was very free. We were very happy. The market was just getting really interested in white Burgundy, and I had a beautiful range to offer up. Prices were going up a little by little, but not too much. It made everybody happy. So it was a very happy time at the time.
So it was a good time to have two kids.
Very good time.
But Guillaume had some medical difficulties. He had some health issues. And when you took the job at Domaine Le Fleuve, you told them that you also needed time away from the domain to take Guillaume to the different tests that were necessary in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Guillaume, who was born on the same day as me, only in 1980, we realized after 6 months that he had a genetic condition, neurofibromatosis. So there was two possible conclusions to this condition. One was he would just have sort of coffee-colored spots on his skin, and the other one, much graver, much more dangerous. But they couldn't tell them if it was going to happen or not. We found out when the first scanners got to Dijon, when he was about 2.5 years old, that he also had a tumor on the ocular nerve. The regional medical teams who were taking care of this decided that really this was a case to go up to Paris because they felt that they were not as well equipped. In 1983, Guillaume had a first radiotherapy to try to stop this. We knew, however, that his eye was blind. So in 87, there was a development problem right at the base of the neck. They had to have second series of radiotherapies. That's where we were at when we joined Le Fleuve. But he also needed growth hormones because the radiotherapy had stunted his growth. Basically, he had a normal life until 1991, with the exceptions that he had to go up to Paris often to have medical procedures performed or tests done. Until 91, everything went pretty well, but then after that, he had the development of that second tumor. He was starting to get itches and scratches all over, and then not feeling very sure on his feet. It was decided to have an operation. This was an extraordinarily difficult operation in the base of the neck. And after that, he was handicapped. So my wife stopped working so that she could take care of him 100%. This lasted until 1997 when his body gave out through the pressure of the maladies.
This life experience that you had with the health of your son affected your thoughts about vineyard work, because you were hesitant to trust chemicals that had been developed by scientists, because you saw that even the best scientists and the best hospitals in the world were not able to help your son in a way that you would have liked. And so you started to distrust this idea that science had all the answers for nature.
Oui. Je vais reprendre l'année 1980.
We were only using contact products on the vineyards. These products were diluted in water, they were sprayed on the vineyards, but at the first rain, they got washed away. In 1970, we started to see penetrating products. So, for example, if you sprayed on the leaf, it would literally penetrate the leaf. It couldn't be washed off, and it was still acting on the plant. Only 3 years after that, then we started having systemic products, which are sprayed on the vineyards and through the leaf, literally make their way to the sap and follow the sap's flow back down into the rootstock. At first, we were all amazed and happy to see that we had products that worked so well to keep the vine so clean and free of any malady. So that was short-lived. We started to see that these products preferred resisting plants. And after just a very short number of years, we started to see that the other ones were doing even worse than they had done before. And we started to see that the products were maybe worse than the maladies themselves. So it's the same problem with antibiotics. Once you choose a class of antibiotics to take care of something and a certain set of things you can treat with it, the next time around, you're going to have to take something stronger from a different family, and it's an infernal circle. So the 80s, the decade of the 80s, was for me a decade of reflection on how can we protect these vines without necessarily having recourse to chemicals. The only people we saw coming to us with anything were basically chemical salesmen who did not really want to think about your job and about what it was doing to the plant or anything like that. They wanted to make sure that they made the sale. Joining Le Fleuve was really interesting for me because he thought that by joining one of the top white domain in Burgundy, he was going to find solutions. Because of who they were, they had the best access to the best specialists. Consultants would come. They were always the best. And I had a lot of hope. I rapidly realized that the situation was worse than at home, because not only did they have the best consultants, they were also the best salespeople, and the doses that they were using on the vineyards were the highest because they had literally been able to talk every single level of employee there into using the highest doses. The difference between Domaine Le Fleuve and my domain is basically, at my domain, I was the decider and the person who did the work. At Le Fleuve, there was, of course, the vignerons that were working in the vines, but then there was a head vigneron, and then there was a régisseur, and then after that there was a board of directors with the four different branches of the Le Fleuve family. So I didn't have answers. I had more questions. But there was a very happy moment when Anne-Claude started to talk to me about wanting to go organic or biodynamic. So we did our first try in 1990-1991 with Claude and Lydia Bourguignon and Mr. Boucher, who helped us through the process. The idea, of course, of these tests were to produce drinkable wine and produce enough of it so that the domain would continue to live. However, it was a revolution. In fact, this helped me tremendously because I did not have the time to engage the same tryouts in my estate. So I was very happy to be able to do this at Le Fleuve. One of the main things about organic production is working the soil. So we had to learn how to till the soils again the way they used to be done. The 1991 campaign was a success. So it was decided that we would extend the tryouts to all levels of appellation, because it was important to taste the wine side by side and see what the qualitative differences were between the regular production and this new production. Because, of course, having beautiful soils is one thing, but what is of great interest to any domain is being able to sell the wines and having interest from the drinking public.
Domaine Le Fleuve at that time controlled over 20 hectare vineyards in a number of different Premier Crus and Grand Cru, and that allowed you room to do side-by-side trials because there was enough vineyard surface that you could try doing organic and then later biodynamic in one parcel and conventional in another and see what the results were.
Oui, exactement.
The first tryout at Domaine Le Fleuve was biodynamic and not organic. That came later. We were able to do parcels that were side-by-side, but not only side-by-side, we used the same plant material, same date of plantation, and so on, so that everything that could be identical would be. And I already was making moves on trying to get things separated so that we could see each style of each parcel. Right before he got hired, Vincent Le Fleuve said to him, if we hire you at Domaine Le Fleuve, it's to make Le Fleuve wine, not to make Moray wine. You understand that? And he answered, well, what interests me is to make Clavoyon, Pucelle, Batard, great terroirs.
During the 20 years you were at Domaine Le Fleuve, the chef de culture changed, right?
Oui, effectivement, quand je suis arrivé...
Michel Tussaud was head of viticulture at the time I joined the domain. Might have had some issues with what we were doing. But he retired rather rapidly. And then we got Mr. Bido, who was already at the domain and already been working at the domain and did see for himself the changes that were happening and liked them and was a great partner.
And so Anne-Claude Le Fleuve, where was she at in her thinking about farming when she arrived?
En fait, son intégration au domain...
Anne-Claude was part of the domain board of directors since 86, joined the domain as a co-CEO in 1990. And then the seminal moment at which she got a great interest in biodynamie was during an open day at the Rateau cellar in Beaune. And she met also Claude and Lydia Bourguignon that day. So at the time, I knew nothing about biodynamics. Of course, once I started reading about this, I was extremely interested, and the tryouts started literally that year.
The domain went fully organic by 92, and then it was biodynamic by 1997.
En totalité, oui. Oui.
Yeah, that's exactly it. 1992 for organic, and then 97 biodynamic fully. So for 2 years, we conducted tests side by side, chemical versus biodynamic. These tests lasted 2 years, and the choice was clear. So in my domain, I had stopped all herbicides earlier. I did not see any future for a chemical approach to viticulture. I had planned to go fully organic 92-93, which I did. And Claude wanted to start at the same time, but her father was holding out. So, of course, I had passionate exchanges with Vincent Le Fleuve, who talked to me about his life in Indochina and in the United States. So one night he asked me, you know, Anne-Claude really wants to go all the way organic. What do you think about it? What have you done in your domain? And Pierre answered, well, we've already made the decision. Oh, so let's go. The next day, Vincent announced it to his daughter, who was extraordinarily happy for the decision. And then from 92 to 97, they continued their tests, but instead of doing chemical versus biodynamics, they did organic versus biodynamic.
And what were those two people like, Vincent Leflève and then Anne-Claude Leflève, as people, what were they like?
Je crois que c'était un monsieur...
Well, he couldn't be my father, but I would have loved to have him as an uncle. He was not very tall or big man or anything. He was sort of medium build, but he had a way of carrying himself that immediately inspired respect. He had had a previous career as a salesman in the steel industry and was very infatuated with stainless steel to the point where they replaced some pickets in the vines with stainless steel. It didn't last very long. Anne-Claude was his first daughter. He had lived the life, as one says, for years and years, and he married rather late. And he had a very special attachment to Anne-Claude. Anne-Claude was a really warm person and a really inviting person. And we would have never been able to go that fast into biodynamics had she had not had a very early interest in nature and plants and homeopathic processes. And she was very curious, very multidimensional, somebody who had a lot of different passions. Anne-Claude, of course, left us rather rapidly. She chose not to take medication, which was part of her principles. Maybe it would have happened differently had she had recourse to chemistry. But she didn't want to do that. She wanted to respect her choices all the way throughout.
When you were doing microvenifications of crews, what did you learn about those crews?
Oui, je disais que nous avions gagné du temps en
So we were able to progress really rapidly because we associated our head viticulturist to our tastings of each parcel, and he could taste the difference in the glass and immediately think of the place it was from, the plant material, and so on, and propose some necessary changes. So essentially, we would do things like modify the length of the pruning or the height of the pruning, and of course, the debudding.
You also started to prune and trim later in the year, right?
Oui, bien sûr, mais ça, c'est lié.
To respect the solidity of a vine, you need to respect its cycles. And for example, pruning prior to all the leaves having fallen off the plant is catastrophe. You need to work with the cycles of the vines, and this biodynamic approach permits you to pay more attention to that. You need also the sap to reflow down so that the plant keeps its reserves rather than cutting it off and letting it seep out.
The Lafon Le Marocher parcel and the Domaine Leflève Le Marocher parcel. How did you see those parcels as different in terms of farming and working them?
Ce n'est pas très différent parce qu'à l'origine...
It's quasi the same parcels because they were part of the same parcel to start out with. Either in 1920 or 1921 is when this parcel went up for sale. And the parcel was cut in three lengthwise. The closest part to Chassagne-Marché is Lafon. The part in the middle is now Domaine de la Romanée-Conti, but was not at the time. The next parcel was Fleurot-la-Rose, which then got subdivided into several different parcels, of which the parcel of Leflève is. So it's the same inclination facing south. The only difference is that it might be a meter or so higher in altitude on the Leflève part versus the Lafon part.
Domaine Leflève purchased that parcel in 1991.
Oui, le 18 juin, exactement.
Yeah, the 18th of June was quite a sensation at the time because that was the first time a Puligny domaine picked Le Montrachet. At the time, there was no other domaine in Puligny who actually picked Montrachet. It was not that simple to incorporate such a small piece of Montrachet. It's 890 square meters. It's really tiny. Questions like, how are we going to press this? Because the presses are too large that we have. What are we going to barrel it in? Didn't know exactly how much it was going to produce, so they had to purchase a series of barrels that were of different sizes. What do you think they did well? Vincent Leflève asked Pierre, do you think it's really worth it That's such a small parcel and so much money. You work with the Montrachet. Is it really worth it? Pierre answered, it's really a magical place. And you'll see that once you start working with this wine, there's people that will be coming to you from the world over just to taste this.
So your predecessor there as registrar at Domaine Le Fleuve had been Jean Viraud, who had taken over from his father, Francois Viraud. What was the style of the winemaking under Viraud, and how did that change under you?
The physical plants themselves are different between my domain and Le Fleuve. In Puligny, as you know, there is no underground cellars. Everything is above ground. So there's a change right then and there of the different types of wineries that you can use. And everything was, of course, cooled, but it wasn't an underground. So instead of the straight 12 months that Le Fleuve was doing at the time with a little bit of tank and then bottling, I changed one little thing. We used to bring wines up to the domain, small tanks, and their small cellar for tasting purposes so that the CEOs could take clients tasting right then and there at the prestigious place. Well, at one point I started refusing to do that because it would permit me to do a little longer élevage like I was doing at Pierre Moret, which is more along the lines of 18 months rather than 12 months.
So just to give an overview of the winemaking at the time, it would have been Damy cooperage, it would have been Mallow in barrel, a bit of Batonnage, and then it would finish in steel 8 to 10 months in steel, and then it would be bottled.
Oui, c'est ça. Je pense que mon arrivée a...
So François Viraud was certainly doing more batonnage than Jean Viraud. Jean Viraud, on the last 3 years of being at the Domaine, was not as involved, and he doesn't really know why. For whatever reason, it was not as involved. But there was a little bit less batonnage. What I did is I brought back a little bit more batonnage.
And that would play into what you said earlier about being very careful about the settling of the lees, what is known as débourbage, because you were putting some of the lees into the barrel and you were doing a little batonnage. Not a ton, but some.
Oui, c'est ça, mon début.
We had very, very clean crops, and this permitted us to get very, very clean and beautiful lees. Not a lot of lees, but they were very healthy.
And you were using pneumatic presses. Horizontal pneumatic presses.
Oui, dès mon arrivée.
They had purchased those presses about 4 years prior to my arrival. Direct pressing and pneumatic presses. The grapes were not destemmed for the whites prior to being put into the press. We did introduce at one point a small grape crusher towards the end. For the last 3-4 years I was there, there was a grape crusher. And that permitted a slightly better ease of pressing in years that had an abundant harvest.
And as we mentioned, the wine spent several months in stainless steel before bottling.
C'était pas important pour moi.
It wasn't important for me. It was imposed by the situation. So in order to do a long élevage in a barrel, and if you decide to do that in the domain, you need at least 2 cellars so that you can switch from 1 year to the next and still leave wines in the cellar during harvest. This was not possible at Domaine Le Fleuve because a regular harvest would have been about 500 barrels. That means 1,000 barrels to house if you're going to do your long, long élevage. So the situation forced us, in a sense, to go to stainless steel for longer periods. So he thinks that the reason, one of the reasons possibly that the gentleman, Mr. Viraud, sort of was less engaged on the end of his career was because the domain was growing tremendously, the amounts of wine was growing tremendously, and it was just not something he was terribly comfortable with. By the time I got there, they were in the midst of purchasing more and more vineyards. And at the time, on average, out of 18 hectares when he arrived, one was replanted every year. which makes a huge turnover. It also makes huge yields. And it was very, very hard to handle this big, big turnover. It's also to be noted that Puligny is more productive than Meursault, for example, and especially in the villages and the Bourgognes, which are very close to the water table. In Côte d'Or, Domaine Lefleve is now 25 hectares. Of course, there's a number of hectares down in the Mâconnais that come and are added to this equation.
So did you ever do initial fermentation in tank in steel? Not just élevage, but did you do an actual fermentation in steel?
En inox, jamais.
So no, I don't do it in stainless steel. If I have to do it, I try to use another type of cuve. And I might have had recourse to doing that on small lots in 1988, where we had a very abundant vintage, but I don't recall exactly. And at Domaine Lefebvre, when I first got there, there were fooders. There was five or six different fooders, 45 hectoliters. There were two old ones, extremely thick, probably Hungarian wood, which were excellent and really had a good taste. And then Olivier had tasted a Ruilly done on a foudre, a new foudre, and had been terribly excited about it. And he and Anne-Claude decided to purchase several foudres for the domain. But Pierre was never quite happy with the results in those foudres. He saw one or two harvests of Clavoyant and Pucelle go through the foudres, and he was shaking his head. So at his arrival, his first order of business was to make sure that everything was going to go through barrels, small Burgundian regular barrels. The real changes were first triage of the grapes, and second of all, the vinification of everything in barrel.
And how would you handle malolactic?
Donc les différences.
Since 1989, we've had a lot of very early vintages, and because the cellars are still rather warm, the malolactics have a tendency to start earlier.
Did you see differences vinifying your own fruit in Meursault underground than in vinifying fruit in Puligny above ground?
Alors pour les fermentations alcooliques,
for the alcoholic fermentations, there's a great advantage to vinify above ground because you can evacuate carbonic gas really easily. There's not much difference in the end, because you have control over the temperature and the humidity, and they're very similar to underground cellars. It's true that it's natural when it's in a cellar underground, but it's controlled when it's above ground.
Anne-Claude Lefleve told me that 1999 was her personal favorite vintage, and I wonder if you might talk us through some of your favorite vintages over the 20 years that you were there.
Je sais pas, bon, je suis forcément influencé par la mauvaise.
It's difficult for me to answer the question because obviously a large part of my tenure there was during the Primox years. 2006 was my last 100% my vinification. My bottling, I saw everything through from one end to the other. So 1999 was really the most accomplished first vintage following the introduction of biodynamics. I love 2000 and 2001. We had a tasting with the Lefleve family, and we had some 2006s, but they were not very good. They definitely had issues. So he proposed comparative tasting because he had never experienced this. The tasting revealed that there was great differences between the two locations, some bottles coming from Moray, the others of the domains. The only thing he can is that there might have been a humidity issue. And he did hear that some of the hygrometry equipment had been malfunctioning at the domain. But he still remembers a taster there that says, oh, when Lefebvre is good, it's very, very good. The difficulty is to be good all the time. What's really surprising is that we've had oxidation problems that had never occurred before. Why? I don't know. I can't answer it. And the research that's being done by the BIVB has not been published, and we don't have any answers yet. You could say, for example, maybe it's due to pollution, and that brought a residue that we are not accounting for at the particular time that has an influence on the wine and bottle. You know, air, a lot of car travel, so on and so forth. This is not something that really was as prevalent prior. It can come from pollution from the products that were used in the soil. There can still be some of those products in the soil, even people that have stopped using the products. And of course, there's a number that continue to use them. I'll just talk about Roundup, for example, which got here in 1979, was largely used throughout the vineyards in the 80s, and the first time it appeared in the water table was in 1998. It took 20 years to get there. We actually can test for Roundup in human urine all around agricultural areas in the world and find it. So it might be a cross-contamination, cross-pollution, something like that. That might be part of the problem. We're doing all the right work. We're being more and more rigorous, both in the cellars, at the vineyards. The bottling equipment has gotten way better. We're improving in all kinds of areas, trying to keep it as clean as possible. Yet, this still happens.
So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about your own domain, Domaine Pierre Marais, where it actually seems like there's been very little Primox problem.
He's very happy to know that there's not very many, but he still does find some every once in a while. And he'd be very happy to eliminate them if he could.
So some of my favorite wines from Pierre Marais are Meursault Tesson, Meursault Perrier, and Volnay-Saint-Anneau. And I was wondering if we could speak about those terroirs for a moment.
Bien sûr, oui.
We can talk about the Tesson first, which is a marvelous vineyard, which is amazingly not a Premier Cru, even though Laval had classed it as a first-class site. You've got to look at history to find the answer here. The Tesson was mostly unplanted at the time, and that's why it didn't make it into the classification. We have to thank Giroudeau because of his Clos de Mon Plaisir label. People are starting to put Tesson on the label again, which is really nice to see. The view is absolutely splendid from up there, and our ancestors had built afternoon shacks to spend the afternoon outdoors from up there. So it's very well exposed, except it's slightly north-facing. So it's a very, very late harvest. You've got to pick this late in the harvest. It doesn't have the opulence of Terre Blanche or Goutte d'Or. However, the minerality is gorgeous and the length is superb. Perrier is a minerality plus-plus. But you still have those slightly charred notes, torrefaction notes on the wines, which allows a lot of people to actually blind this wine, even young. And I think it's the Meursault that has the best potential for laying down. Volnay-Saint-Anneau, which is actually in the Meursault commune, we had the marvelous opportunity to purchase a plot of Volnay-Saint-Anneau in 2003, and our first harvest is 2004. So these are often very powerful wines, even massive sometimes, but have extraordinary potential for aging. When people would come to taste at the Domaine, our two top red Premier Crus are Bemard-Epineau and Volnay-Saint-Anneau. And at the end of the tasting, clients would usually go like, I think you tasted us on those wines backwards, because this particular plot of Bemard-Epineau is all in finesse and elegance and delightful, whereas the Volnay-Saint-Anneau is way more massive.
How would you say that the winemaking, in terms of vinification technique, has evolved since the 80s to now.
Alors, en matière de vinification, les modifications sont essentiellement pour
What really changed over that period of time was the vinification of the reds. And the arrival of Anne in the domain to work with me was capital in that respect. Since the time of the métayage I had with the Lafonce and also the métayage from the Poiriers, I was very much focusing on how to make the best white wine. My focus on the whites, unfortunately, took the focus off the reds. I wasn't a very good red vinifier at the time. And it took until about 85, 86 for me to really get those wines vinified right. And with the disappearance of the Lafonce métayage looming, I thought to myself, I better take care of what I got. And I've got a Premier Cru red, and that's Pommard Epinot. So I started to turn my attention to that. And on the guides, there was often written, Pierre Marais, great address for the whites, forget the reds. And after a while, that sort of got to me. So at the time, I was very lucky to meet people like Henri Jaillet, who gave me a few pointers rather rapidly, got me on the right tracks. Probably our first really good vintage in red is 88. During Anne's studies, I told her, listen, really try to brush up on the reds because I can give you a few elements on the whites that will be helpful, but the reds are where we really need some help. It's almost impossible today to grow a domain on a family basis because of the pricing of land. So we decided that we are going to do our best to produce the best wines that we can produce. My daughter has taken on the flame, and then there's the next generation who's finishing up his school a couple of years from being out of school and is going to be joining us. And there's some bright future there.
Pierre Marais has had three careers, any one of which would be considered extraordinary. Thank you very much for being here today.
Je me suis passionné
I was
pour le métier de...
passionate for this life from the moment I knew how to walk. That's what I can remember.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pierre Marais of Domaine Pierre Marais in Meursault, and also Moray Blanc, the micro-négociant, also in Meursault.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's I-L-L, drinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.
The writings of Clive Coates were helpful to me when I was doing background research for this interview, particularly Coates' book, Cote d'Or, A Celebration of the Great Wines of Burgundy, and I would recommend that book to you if you would like to know more about Pierre Marais. Also, this interview would not have happened without an incredible amount of help from the Wasserman family, particularly Becky Wasserman, who opened her home to me, and to Peter Wasserman, who donated his time to translate this interview with Pierre Marais. I owe huge thanks to the Wasserman family for their support. Anne-Claude Lefleuve told me that 1999 was her personal favorite vintage, and I wonder if you might talk us through some of your favorite vintages over the 20 years that you were there.
Je sais pas, je suis forcément influencé par la mauvaise réputation des vins des années 2000 qui vieillissent mal. Forcément influencé par la mauvaise réputation d'oxydation prématurée des vins actuellement. Bon, moi, j'ai quitté le domaine en 2008 et à ce moment-là, Je n'avais pas le sentiment qu'il y avait des bouteilles détériorées par des mauvaises conservations. Bon. Quelques années après, on a crié à la catastrophe dans beaucoup d'endroits, ou presque. Et je me suis moi-même posé beaucoup de questions, parce que j'étais responsable de la production des millésimes jusqu'à... Alors, le dernier que j'assume complètement en responsabilité technique, c'est 2006. Puisque 2007, j'étais là aux vendanges, mais je n'étais plus là à la mise en bouteille. Et 2008, je n'étais pas là aux vendanges. Ce qui était peut-être les plus aboutis, effectivement, 99 était peut-être le premier produit par la biodynamie avec tout ce que l'on avait souhaité mettre en place. Oui, donc 2000 et 2001, que j'ai pratiquement épuisé maintenant de mes bouteilles, j'aimais personnellement beaucoup. Alors, 2002, ben, il commence à y avoir apparemment des bouteilles qui vieillissent mal. Je n'en ai pratiquement plus. Mais là, je voudrais faire une différence entre les endroits où sont conservées les bouteilles. J'ai été amené à une occasion de déguster des bâtards 2006 du domaine Le Fleuve, alors qu'il y avait toute la famille qui était là. Et ces bouteilles étaient dans un état épouvantable. C'était il y a un an et demi, à peu près. Et on m'a dit que pourtant, ces bouteilles avaient été coravinées quelques jours auparavant, qu'elles avaient été considérées comme bonnes, et là, elles étaient trépassées. Et j'avais donc proposé dans la foulée au gérant actuel de faire une comparaison de ce millésime entre les bouteilles qui étaient au domaine Le Fleuve et les bouteilles qui étaient dans ma cave privée, pour essayer d'évaluer s'il n'y avait pas un problème de conservation chez eux, parce que personnellement, quand je goûtais des vins Le Fleuve, je n'avais jamais eu auparavant de bouteilles aussi oxydées que celles que j'avais eues à cette réunion familiale. Alors, nous avons fait cette dégustation quelques semaines après, et nous avons pu constater qu'il y avait manifestement des écarts de conservation entre la cave Le Fleuve et la cave Morée. Voilà. Alors, pour quelles raisons, je n'en sais rien. Est-ce qu'il y a eu des phénomènes de contamination? Est-ce qu'il y a eu... J'ai cru entendre qu'il y avait eu beaucoup d'appareils d'hygrométrie qui étaient tombés en panne et qui n'avaient pas été restaurés. Et je peux supposer que beaucoup de dégâts viennent de là. Je me souviens d'un mot d'un des dégustateurs qui est là, qui disait « Ah oui, quand même, Le Fleuve, quand c'est bon, c'est sacrément bon. » La difficulté, c'est d'être bon tout le temps, partout.